2003 Sunstone Symposium West, held in San Francisco on April 19th, presents session number 51, Coping in the Merry Old Land of Odds, by Robert Kirby.
Welcome, 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 welcome. Be quiet. Listen. Shush. Excellent. Oh, the Boy Scouts. Cub Scouts? Not the peace sign. Yeah. Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. Glad you are here. We trust you blessed your own food before you ate it. I'm Carol Quist F. of the Sunstone office in Salt Lake City, standing in for Dan Weatherspoon, our director, whose mother died on Wednesday. Some of you may not have heard on last night at the session. So he, with his family, is in San Diego and unable to be with you. Wishes he could be with you. Naturally, he's where he should be. We are pleased to have you here. Hope you have been enjoying the various sessions that you've attended. I have certainly been enjoying seeing the people that I see other years when I've been able to come either to the LA or the San Francisco area. We're very pleased to have with us to speak to you today Robert Kirby, presently a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune in Salt Lake City. Very witty, very wry, very on point with his little compliments and skewers of things Mormon. He's a former police officer. He presently has 8 books to his credit, although one will not be out for another year until next spring. Please buy his books and other books. Patronize our vendor out in the hall. Take home a free copy of the Sunstone anniversary issue from our registration table. The tapes are now being brought out and are available so for purchase as well. But back to Robert Kirby and his books. Family Home Screaming, very, very funny. Go and get his books. The book that's coming out next spring is not a funny one, but stems from his police career, which he had followed for 11 years before going into journalism. He has a great wife, Irene, 3 daughters and a granddaughter. He is in the process of moving from Springville to Riverton, Utah, so he'll be closer to the heart of headquarters. Let's welcome Robert Kirby.
I'd like to say that it's a pleasure to be here, but I'm not going to. In my line of work, it's always a good idea to make sure that you get out of a place with a whole skin before you can say that it was a pleasure to have been there. I never intended to become a writer or even a Mormon writer. It's something that happened entirely by accident. Can you hear me well enough? Or do I have to lean down here? I was a police officer in Springville, which is a small community just south of Provo, and having my first crisis of faith from my lifelong association with Mormonism. My parents were members of the church, or still are. We were in the military, and so I got an atypical Utah upbringing in about 50 different places around the world. And oddly enough, ended up back in Utah when my father retired. I was a police officer, and I was having this crisis of faith about how do you get someone like me to exist successfully in a highly structured environment. And I came down to the point where I thought, I'm going to have to leave the church if I want to be me. And that was the conclusion that I came to. And one day I stumbled across this article written by Bonner Ritchie about organizational abuse. And everything about it kind of resonated. You know the sort of feeling that you're supposed to get when you read the Book of Mormon? Well, I got that reading about organizational abuse, and I said, yeah, he's writing about me in the church. And the one thing that he said that has stuck with me ever since was that you cannot make organizations safe for people. You can only make people safe for organizations, which has kind of become the hallmark of my writing. And because I lampoon Mormons so much in my writing, I get people who will come up and challenge me about that. You know, how can you say these things about the true church? And the only explanation I can come up with for them is that there's no guarantee that having the truth actually makes you smart. And if you want to say that the church is true, I'm okay with that, but what's that got to do with you being an idiot? And so what I write is just sort of the stuff that it takes to make the organization safe for me. This is how people like me cope with going to church with people like that. Or in another way, this is what keeps me from taking a gun to high priest group. I was still a police officer when I hit on the idea of becoming a writer. I've always had sort of an aberrant sense of humor. I learned that the importance of humor while I was a police officer, because in that particular profession, you got a chance to see a lot and do a lot of very terrible things. And if you don't learn to laugh fairly early on, you're going to go insane. And so police officers and people in this kind of an environment, whether they're nurses or any other public safety worker, they develop a kind of a hard-bitten or a cynical sense of humor as a way of coping with the psychological rigors of the job. And I have a rather serious countenance. I don't smile all that often. And I learned fairly early on that if I kept a perfectly straight face, I could say virtually anything and people would believe me. So if I would stop people for speeding, I became a police officer after I came home from an LDS mission, which was quite a switch. And I back up a little bit. I gained a real appreciation for the Roman centurions who garrisoned Jerusalem about the time of Christ. That enforcing the law on God's chosen people can really be confusing sometimes. And I would stop people for speeding. At this particular time, I was working in Tooele County in Utah. I tell everybody that's where God practiced making people before he got really good at it. And I've had people from Tooele County in the audiences when I've said that, and they all, yeah, that's pretty much true. And so if I would stop people for speeding, and I'd go up to their window and I'd say, I'd like to see your driver's license, your registration, and all your major credit cards, they'd give them to me. And I thought, I can have a lot of fun with this, because here I am working with people who, in Utah, who are by and large very authority-oriented because of the upbringings that they've had in the church and whatnot. So if a person in a position of authority asks them for something, it must be that they have a good reason. So they'd give me their credit cards, and I would look at them and say, we're just checking credit limits. Yours are fine. And they would totally buy into it. Oh, that's great. And they'd drive off. And you know later on they're going to be going, now, wait a minute. But by then you'd already had the benefit of the laugh. And when we would run roadblocks looking for drunk drivers, people would pull into them and into my position in the roadblock, and they'd roll down the window, and they'd be very nervous, as most people are when they get pulled over by the police. They'd say, what's the trouble, officer? And I'd say, we're looking for Democrats. And because by then I was in Utah County, they'd say, well, we don't even know any Democrats. But we sure hope you catch them. And To my credit, I like to argue that I'm doing this in order to alleviate the psychological stresses of the job and also entertain myself at the same time. But there is a physiological benefit that we get to that we get from laughter. Researchers at Loma Linda discovered back in 1994 that when a human being laughs, the body produces gamma interferon and T lymphocytes, which actually help you fight disease. People who laugh a lot tend to be healthier than people who do not. You also get kind of a mini aerobic workout. Your blood pressure goes up, as your heart rate does too. And you get muscle flexion from laughing. There are a lot of positive physical benefits. But the best benefit to laughter is this thing called beta endorphins, which when we laugh, our body produces beta endorphins, and that is the body's own morphine that protects us when in times of great stress, or if you get a leg chopped off or something. Your body will kick these beta endorphins into your bloodstream and you feel high. And so that's another reason why people like to laugh, is because they get these beta endorphins from it, and best of all, they're illegal. So you get this sort of high out of doing it. Well, the problem with that is that, like any other drug, you can abuse it. And if you do it long enough, if you become hooked on it, pretty soon you need an increasing amount to maintain that same level of high. And that's when you start doing things you shouldn't. I stopped this guy for speeding one time, and he gave me his driver's license and his registration, but then he also handed me, just out of the blue, his Temple Recommend, which I thought was really interesting. And so I went back to the car, and I wrote him a ticket for speeding, and then on his Temple Recommend, I wrote void. For those of you who haven't been to the temple in a while, the people whose job it is there to look at these things have no sense of humor about it. If it says void, they don't care who the hell wrote it. You ain't getting in. Well, I thought that was pretty funny, but this guy didn't, and neither did his stake president. And neither did his stake patriarch, who happened to be my police chief. So I got 2 days off without pay for that one. And it was right around then that I realized that I needed to make a transition out of police work. It was a very difficult decision for me because my father had been a police officer and all my brothers are cops and most of my best friends were. And I really didn't know if I could do this. I had started writing this column about police work and why police officers did the things that they did, trying to explain the work to the general public. And I thought there might be a way to leave police work through this. But I still didn't have the courage to make the jump. And one night I was driving around and I had this epiphany, almost a religious one, where I realized I could shoot people, that under the right set of circumstances I could do a lot of really terrible things to my fellow human beings. I could beat them up, I could take them to jail, take their kids away from them, and impound their cars, kick the doors of their houses in. Then, under the right set of circumstances, I could do just about anything that needed to be done, except the one thing that I couldn't do, which was to make fun of them. Unfortunately, that's all I was really good at. And turned out that there was a place that would pay you to do this, rather than suspend you. And so I got into journalism and eventually left. It bothered my family a whole lot. My brothers came to me and said, "Why are you doing this to the family? What's the matter with you? Why do you want to go be a writer instead of a policeman?" And I said, "Well, I can spell and you can't." And so I left. And it was while I was working for a small newspaper in Utah County that I kind of became known for what it is that I do mostly, and that is lampooning the local predominant culture in Utah, which is really easy to do, frankly. And not P.J. O'Rourke, I don't know how many of you know who he is. He's a political commentator, very good writer. He wrote a series of articles years ago about the born-again Christian movement in the United States, where he said that making fun of born-again Christians was like hunting dairy cows with a high-powered rifle and a scope. This is too easy. In large part because there were people who had focused their attention so tightly on their agenda that they'd lost the peripheral view. They'd lost perspective and didn't realize that they'd sort of become something that was easy to mock. And in Utah, the same thing holds true of lampooning my own family, my church, is that when you get a large group of people like this together who think alike and behave alike and act alike, dress alike and look alike, and in many cases are related, that convention becomes more important than conviction, or how we do things becomes more important than why we're doing them in the first place. And when that happens with human beings, you start to check how you're faring in the world by looking out the corners of your eyes at the rest of the herd to see how you stack up. And that's a pretty poor way to go through life. But it's not true just of Mormons or religion. It's true of anyone. Anytime those conditions exist where people are surrounded only by their own kind and they judge how they are in the world, their position in the world with respect to that. One day I was working at the newspaper and the editor came to me and said, would you write an editorial for the paper because the one we had ready to go has fallen through. And for those of you who are not familiar with journalism terms, an article is a basic recitation of the facts. You lay out something that happened or an event or a situation in a very objective way and let the reader make up his or her own mind. Column, on the other hand, is the personal opinion of whatever fool wrote it. And an editorial penned by the newspaper is the actual position of the paper on a particular issue. I didn't know that. I was just this cop who knew how to spell. So I sat down and I wrote this thing called Five Kinds of Mormons. And I hypothesized that of all the millions of Mormons there were in the world, there were only five basic kinds. There were liberal Mormons. There were genuine Mormons, of which there's like 10. There were conservative Mormons, Orthodox Mormons, and Nazi Mormons. And I explained how to recognize all the different types, put it on his desk, and I went home, and he called me late that night and said, what's the matter with you? I said, why, what's wrong? He goes, well, this isn't very good, and it's not very funny. And I said, well, you better not run it then. But he did, and worse, there was a picture of me next to it. And so I went to the paper the next day. Five Kinds of Mormons was in the newspaper, and I was sitting there reading it when the doors of the newsroom burst open, and in stormed the publisher, and being of the latter category of Mormon. He was really upset about this, and he went over to the editor and proceeded to yell at him about the bad journalistic sense it was to print something like this in Utah County, which is essentially the Tehran of Utah. And he predicted we were going to get very angry letters to the editor, and he was right because he went up and wrote the only one we got. So in the next issue of the Journal, there was a letter from the Journal publisher telling all the Journal readers what an idiot one of the Journal writers was. And if that wasn't bad enough, something even worse happened, in that we received a storm of mail from Mormons all over the United States telling the publisher to grow up, that they were Mormons, they liked this sort of humor about Mormons, they knew a lot of Mormons like this, and we should keep doing that. Two things occurred to me as a result of that. One was that there was an actual place for humor about Mormons, even humor that can be sometimes cutting, within the church. And there, the second thing that occurred to me was that I needed a new job. Because when I wouldn't quit doing it, they fired me. But not before I learned some really interesting things about lampooning people's sacred cows. Interesting thing about sacred cows is that we all have them. Getting back to that herd element we were talking about, P.J. O'Rourke hunting dairy cows with a high-powered rifle. The fact of the matter is that this is a human condition. And while I make fun of it within the Mormon context, the same thing is true everywhere else you go. So if you're not a member of the local herd, you're still a cow. Because we all have these sorts of issues. And one of the first things I wrote that prompted a little bit of response was I wrote this column explaining why Mormons, when we sing in church, we sound like an anesthetized dairy herd. Which is true if you compare our music to the music of other churches, which tends to be a little bit more lively. And the column ran, and that next day I got this call from this woman who, ironically enough, I recognized as someone who had just moved into my ward. On the other hand, she didn't know who I was. She just knew I was this jerk at the newspaper. And she said, you must not be a Mormon to say these terrible things about us. I said, no, I'm a Mormon. And she said, well, you must be an inactive Mormon to say such nasty things. I said, no, I go to church. She says, well, you must be on the verge of apostasy then to write this kind of stuff. And I said, well, no, actually, I'm in your bishopric. which was true. And she said, oh, and hung up. And then she called back a few minutes later and said, I've read the column again, and I've decided that there is some humor in it. So some people are so hidebound that they don't understand that you don't need permission to laugh at yourself. In fact, you don't have a sense of humor. Your sense of humor actually has you. You can't make something funny to yourself if it isn't. It's such a spontaneous thing, sort of like the Spirit, right? It became very difficult, because people don't always agree on what constitutes humor, to predict what it would be that would set people off. Excuse me. I personally believe that virtually anything can be funny. The question is, what can you share in a humorous way with other people? If you stop and think about it, sex is pretty darn funny. There's nothing particularly funny, however, about the sexual abuse of children. So within the context of sex, we agree that there are some limits, places where you shouldn't go. You can use humor, on the other hand, to get over the effects of a sexual assault. I've seen people do that. But the question in my situation is, what can I share with the public? And in order to determine that, it was almost impossible to gauge it by the response I was getting, because people in similar situations didn't even always agree with how far the line should be. I get asked so often if I'm afraid of church leaders because of what I write three times a week in the Salt Lake Tribune when I lampoon Mormons. I got asked that so often that I actually wrote this column about it. I said, I'm not afraid of church leaders because they're old. I said, all things being equal, I'm pretty sure I could beat President Hinckley up. I didn't say that I wanted to. I was simply trying to make a point, and that if it was just the president and I out behind the church, I could probably take him. And I was ecumenical about it. I said I could beat up the Pope, and Mother Teresa couldn't take a punch, and Billy Graham was sick, so why on earth would I be afraid of church leaders? And I turned that in and started thinking about it on the drive home, and I thought, that's a bad idea. Because if there's a place in the world where you shouldn't say that you can beat up President Hinckley, it's probably Utah. But it was done, and so when I went to work the next day, I was really nervous about how this was going to be received. And I fully expected there to be a hue and a cry from my head. But all I got from that particular column was just dead silence. Nobody said anything. No letters, no emails, no angry phone calls. Now you compare that situation to a column I wrote several weeks later where I said that you can tell the difference between God and Satan and their personality types by the sorts of pets they own. God has this really cool dog named Vern. And Satan has a cat, and I got 500 letters from cat owners. They came from all over the country, in fact. They have pictures of cats and poems about cats. And one guy sent me a photocopy of his cat's butt. And I remember looking at this mail and wondering what the hell is the matter with these people. Because I said I could beat up President Hinckley and nobody said a word to me. And I said this stupid thing about cats and everybody came unglued. And so there was no predicting what it was that would set people off. I think in large part because when you're lampooning religion, there aren't a lot of people out there doing it, and so it's not a well-beaten path. And you sort of have to make the rules up as you go along. It is possible, however, to go too far, and I'm the first person to agree with that. About 4 months after I wrote the column saying I could beat up President Hinckley, I got a call from my stake president. And that's the difficult part of lampooning an organization that has an eternal perspective of things. Is that 4 months to them is like tomorrow. And I'd already done some other stuff. And so when he called, I said, sure, I'll come down and talk to you. And went down there, and it was a very formal visit. He's a nice man, my stake president. He's not anymore, but I got a new one. That's not my fault. He said, Robert, you wrote a column several months ago where you said you could beat up President Gordon B. Hinckley. And I said, yeah, I know, I can. And that, when you say things like that, when people get humor at them, coming at them from a different angle than they're used to, they don't know quite how to take it. And you can actually sit there and watch their brain and their face have a race. And he said, well, be that as it may, don't you think that's a little irreverent? And I said, well, maybe a little. And he said, well, apparently it's a lot because I have this note from one of the brethren asking me to talk to you and see if we can get you to tone it down a little bit. And I said, well, that's fair. I mean, I'm a Mormon and I submit myself to a certain amount of ecclesiastical authority. And they have, if I'm going to comment on the church, they have a right to comment on what it is that I do. And I ended up having this telephone conversation / interview with this general authority, and don't ask me who it is because I won't tell you. He explained why he thought this was this crossed the line. I explained to him why I thought it was funny, and I even went into an explanation of how you make a joke. He still didn't laugh. So I agreed. I said, okay, I'm willing to tone it down a little bit. And on the way home from that, I thought, well, it's entirely possible that I offended President Hinckley. He seems like a man with a pretty good sense of humor, but you never know. So I went home and I wrote him a letter of apology. I said, dear President Hinckley, I'm sorry I said I could beat you up. In my defense, I did not say that I wanted to. I was simply trying to be funny. I hope you understand that it's the nature of my job to do this sort of thing. However, if you were offended, I do apologize, and we'll try to do a little bit better in the future. P.S. I think I could still beat up the Pope. True story. And I thought that would be the end of it. Because the beauty about apologizing to a church leader is if you say you're sorry, they have to forgive you. It's not like the police department. And so I thought that would be the end of it, but a couple weeks later I went to my mailbox and there was this letter from the office of the First Presidency. I couldn't bring myself to open it up. I was terrified. I've been making fun of Mormons now for 10 years, and that's the only time I've ever been truly terrified. Because I looked at this envelope for the longest time, and I couldn't shake this thought that, crap, I'm going to Africa. It happened like this before. But I finally got the courage to open it up, and it was actually a letter from one of President Hinckley's secretaries. who said, "I've discussed the matter with the president. He wishes me to assure you that he is not offended. Good luck. Have fun." So now when I get called in, I take this letter with me. I let them look at it, but they can't touch it. And so even in the context of church leaders, it's difficult to see, to understand what constitutes legitimate humor. Do I believe that there are lines that you shouldn't cross? Of course I do. I don't make fun of Catholic Mass. I don't make fun of the traditions of other religions any more than I make fun of Mormon temple ordinances. There are just some things that you don't do if you want to share your message with other people. There's a social benefit to laughing, that when you can get someone to laugh at you, laugh with you in a self-deprecating way, suddenly you're an interesting person. You're not as threatening. You're certainly not the stereotype that they may have expected you to be. I learned that on an LDS mission to South America. I wasn't a particularly good missionary. I had a dog. We weren't supposed to have pets, but I had one. And towards the end of my mission, they sent me to this little tiny town in Uruguay. San Jose was what it was called. It was at the end of the Vietnam War. Nobody liked Americans particularly. And to them, we were just these tall, rich, blonde North American kids who'd been sent down to bug them about Jesus. And they didn't want to have anything to do with us, and so they would throw things at us and call us names and slam the doors in our faces. I got bored with that. And I had a brand new missionary as a companion, Elder English, and one day my dog was a big German Shepherd Greyhound mix. His name was Lurch. And one day, out of sheer boredom, I put a pair of gym shorts on him and a white shirt and a necktie and a name tag, and I told my companion, I said, "Come on, we're going to work." And he really stressed. But he says, you're not taking the dog out dressed like that, are you?" I said, "Why not?" And he said, "What if the mission president sees us?" And I said, "The mission president? God's watching us right now. What are you worried about the mission president for?" And so we went to work, and it worked out great because English was so mortified by this that he wouldn't go up to the door with me. And so I'd knock on the door, and the people would come there, and they'd fling it open, and here's the damn Mormons again. And there's two bikes, and there's two briefcases. And there's two Mormons, but one of them's a dog. And if you don't laugh, they don't know what to do. They sort of just wait to see what's going to happen. And it's that whole brain face race thing again. And so while they're sitting there wondering if they should mention it, you just go into your spiel, "Hi, I'm Elder Kirby, Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day." They're still stuck on the dog. We did that for a couple of weeks and eventually had to quit doing it. Elder English started running out of white shirts. Turns out there's a reason why dogs don't wear them. And the assistants to the president found out we were doing it, and they drove out to San Jose really fast, and they were really upset, and they said, "You're giving people the wrong idea about the church. You got to quit doing this. And besides, it says in the missionary handbook you're not supposed to have pets, so you have to get rid of this dog." And that's the first time I realized that I was a sunstoner. Because I was at the end of my mission and an unpaid volunteer in the bargain, and so I said, "Or what?" And they didn't have a good answer to that, so they left. I kept the dog, but we did stop using him as a tracking tool. We never converted anybody because of Lurch. We probably would have probably go to hell if we had. But something just as important happened. And that is, after a few days of doing this, suddenly people weren't calling us names anymore. Suddenly, they would, if they heard we were in the neighborhood, they would actually come out of their houses to talk to us, because we stopped being that thing they thought we were, that thing that was easy to figure out, even though they were wrong, and suddenly we became somebody they might be interested in getting to know. We made a lot of really good friends. And most of the time, that's the best you can hope for. There is no way you can bring everybody in the world around to your way of thinking. It just won't happen, regardless of whether what you have is the truth or not. And the best you can hope for is to make a friend out of them. Because the truth of the matter is that regardless of our differences, we have far more in common than we do not. Now, life occasionally teaches us that in very ugly and terrible ways. When we watch the towers collapse, it suddenly didn't make any difference what color you were, what religion you professed, what your politics were. Suddenly, we were all brothers and sisters, and not just in-laws either. We were the real thing. But the further we come away from that, the more diligently we're back to digging those moats and building those boxes to put people in, because it's easy to figure them out when we do that. And we shouldn't do that. It makes no sense to do that, but human beings are amazing in our diligence for stupidity. Humor, I believe, is the best interpersonal relationship skill there is. A lot of people will say, no, that's sex. But if you're, regardless of what your wiring is, you can really only have sex with about 50% of the planet. Whereas humor you can have with everybody. And so I believe it's the most effective tool. Now, we talked a little bit about the psychological and the physiological benefits and the social benefits of humor. That's the sort of stuff I tell myself when I'm feeling noble. The truth of the matter is that I'm probably still just a little boy teasing a dog through a fence with a stick. I work at the church's family history library. That's my church job. I think they got together and said, we're going to have to release him from the bishopric. Where can we send him where he won't screw things up? No, we'll put him to work on dead Mormons. So they sent me down to the family history library, thinking that I couldn't cause a problem down there, but I fooled them. People who do genealogy, for Mormons it's extra credit work, people who do genealogy tend to be really focused about it, and they're not expecting humor. They'll come in with a disc and computer disc and say, I've got my family's names ready to go to the temple. Can you help me get this temple ready? And I'll tell them, you're sure everybody on here is passed on? Because if we have to kill them for you, it costs extra. And most people will laugh. But there are a few that will look at you like maybe they missed something in church. No, they're dead. I put a sign on the library wall down there, all these official announcements. I thought I'd put up one of my own. I said, attention library patrons, beginning of the year 2000, the LDS Church will no longer do temple work for the French. And people saw that and they stressed. They'd say, oh no, the poor French. First the Jews and now the French. What are we going to do? And finally the librarian saw it and ripped it down. She figured out who'd done it. And then there were a few people who got really angry because they realized somebody had been having fun at their expense. And this one older brother came up to me and said that was a very sacrilegious thing to do. I said, yeah, I know, but it was funny too, right? And he said, well, I don't think so. I said, I know, that's the funny part. Questions about what it is that I do. I promise not to make fun of you here. Got everything? Yes.
Can you read your column on the internet?
Yeah, it's www.sltrib.com.
Can I read your column?
Hold to the ironic rod. The number?
Yeah, the number.
Oh, there's liberal, genuine, and Nazi. The column appears in the Tribune every Monday, Thursday, and Saturday. It's in the lifestyle section now. Guess they're worried about me in theology. But I'm not really interested in theology. For me, it's anthropology. What you believe isn't nearly as important to me as how you behave. I used to think that I had a lot of power as a policeman. I mean, I could shoot people. But I realized I had a whole lot more power as a journalist. When I was a cop, I'd come home, tell my teenage daughters, you know, I got a gun and a nightstick. You better go clean your room. And they wouldn't. But you come home as a journalist and you say, go clean your rooms or I'll make you famous. They go clean their rooms. Yes. Yeah.
And then the other, you have a friend that I, a guy named Larry Urban, who seems to incite you to do everything equally. Would you like to comment about that?
Larry Urban is actually a real person. And we do remarkably stupid things when we get together. There's a symbiosis that occurs between guy friends, just like there is between men and women. You know, you meet somebody and you become instantly romantically involved. Well, there, guys have that same sort of connection with other guys in some cases where you meet somebody and you're instantly trouble-oriented. That there's nothing you can do that doesn't produce a laugh, and that's sort of like Larry and me. And so both of our wives kind of limit our behavior or limit our contact. And the other thing about writing about my wife, yeah, she is a civilizing influence. You're married too, aren't you? Well, there you go. How hard was that to figure out? I wrote a column last week where I said, I mean, the clerics in Baghdad are starting to tell Iraqi women, listen, if your husband's a looter, do not have sex with him. You don't want to endorse this sort of behavior. And I don't know how big of a surprise that is to the rest of the world. That's how my wife takes care of me. If you're going to do that, we're not going to do this. That's how civilization was born, for crying out loud. And of course, there are people who misunderstand that. You get some feminists are so focused on their agenda that they miss that as a element of humor. I wrote a column one time where I said that in 1996, researchers in Denmark discovered that women, or men on average, have 4 billion more brain cells than women. A true story, not collectively either, but that our heads are physically bigger than yours and we have extra brain cells. It didn't say that we were smarter than you or that we even used the brain cells we had, only that we had them. And so I wrote this column where I explained why men historically had to be smarter than women. There were important things to think up, like professional wrestling. I said, there's never been a woman alive smart enough to come up with a way to break another guy's spine using just her forehead. That it had to be a man, and I said that men also thought up grain alcohol and thermonuclear warfare and sacrificing people to idols and impersonating Elvis. And I got this letter back a couple of days later from this woman who said, you pig, men are not smarter than women because they thought up professional wrestling. What good does that do anyone? Sacrificing people to idols is not only stupid and damaging, but it serves no purpose and didn't help the human race at all. So for people like this, the arms are down, the lights are flashing, but there's no train coming. She doesn't realize that her agenda, which is a legitimate one, feminism, is being compromised by her behavior. She's actually become a detriment to it. The worst thing you can do other than offend someone is to take offense when no offense was intended. And you have to be careful about that. I mean, we tend to defend our positions with our egos. And that's the wrong way to go about doing it. But as for my wife, I mean, she's a leavening influence in my life. I had to let one of my daughters guest write one of my columns one time because I'd made fun of my daughter so much I had to make it up to him. She wrote this column, 10 Reasons Why It Bites to Be Robert Kirby's Daughter. She got a bunch of fan mail from people who hate me. And so when I go places now, people ask me if when I'm going to let my guest, my wife, guest write one of my columns, and the answer is never. She's seen me naked. Other questions? To go to church. I mean, I don't know how many of you are active, but if you go to church, you can hear all kinds of stuff. Wards, or religious congregations in general, are like little villages. And there's, you know, a head man and a high council and an alpha female. A bunch of thugs, and like every village, though, there's always one or two idiots. And somebody who will get up in church and say, "Oh, last week one of the three Nephites helped me change a tire." My word, they don't say stuff like that anymore. No lie, I have actually had the stake president stop in the middle of state conference and say, "Robert, this is all off the record." What I write is actually just personal therapy. It's how I cope with going to church like so many of the people that constitute an LDS ward. It is the therapy I use to keep me from taking a gun to high priest group. Yes?
Over the years that you've written it, what trends do you see that Mormons are, patterns that Mormons are changing in your arena?
Yeah, I think we're becoming a little bit more mainstream in our ideology, or how we tend to worship with other people. I attribute a lot of that to President Hinckley, who seems to understand that we don't live in a closet anymore, that more and more people are, the mix in Utah is becoming diluted, in large part because people are now moving to Utah faster than we can reproduce. It didn't always used to be that way, but the statistic I heard not too long ago is that 30% of all Mormons live in interfaith households, and that number is going to continue to grow. And we're going to have to get along with the rest of the world much better than we used to. I also see a growth in the in Mormon humor, like the movies that are coming out. They're not first-rate movies by any means, but they are a start. There's a religion out there that is great at laughing at themselves, the Jewish faith. They have marvelous humorists. It doesn't have anything to do with whether or not their faith is a true faith, but whether or not they can use humor to make themselves feel better about being themselves. A lampoonist is not somebody who degrades people. A lampoonist is someone who reminds people that they're already degraded. Because the fact of the matter is no matter how high the throne you sit on, you still sit on your butt. Not general authorities, but...
A minute ago you said something about laughing makes you live longer.
Mm-hmm.
General authorities must be having a great time.
Well, some of them do. I mean, I'm in Salt Lake all the time, and I bump into some of them, and it's pretty clear that they don't share a common sense of humor. Because you will run into some general authorities who are just really dour. I mean, it's almost like you want to use a stick to see if they're still alive. But you'll run into others that I bumped into them that will who will see me and start laughing immediately. My wife and I were at a gathering of the National Association of Christian and Jews, and we bumped into James Faust, for example. And we were going down the lines and people shaking hands and everything, and he saw me coming. And he caught my eye and just started shaking his head and grinning. And when I got up to him, I thought, I wonder what he's going to say. And he goes, "You columnist." That's the best he could come up with. But he's got a really good sense of humor.
He's also a Democrat.
He's also a Democrat. There you go. I think he's the only one we got in Utah. Other questions? I don't predict that I will get in a lot of trouble with what I do. I mean, I lampoon Mormon behavior, and I can understand how it is possible as a Mormon writer to get into trouble with the church. I'm not interested in the theology or changing things about Mormonism. I'm interested in how average people behave with what they believe. You can have two cultures in the Middle East, for example, who hate each other so intensely that they'll kill each other, completely oblivious to their common roots and the common things that they share. Yes?
I don't follow your call, but I'd just be curious whether you were able to lampoon the scandals in Salt Lake about the Olympics.
To some degree, yes. I tend to stay away from lampooning individuals, in large part because I have done that in the past with people who I knew and ran into their families later on and realized that holding an individual up for public ridicule is hard to do because it's not just them that has to take the derision, but their families also. And so I usually go after groups. And in that particular situation, you can say just about anything you want because it allows people an out. They can duck responsibility for their behavior if they want to. But there have been scandals that go on. I mean, a spokesman for the Olympic Committee said that it was the result of a prophecy of Brigham Young, for example, that we got the Olympics, that the world would come and see Utah for the shining star that it is, and that this was the result of a prophecy made 100 and some odd years ago. I wrote a column about how it was because I thought we bribed them. There are going to be people who don't see that as humorous, but that's okay. Other questions? Okay. Oh, one more question.
Have you ever had an experience where you were, you know, that comment, humor is wages, pretty?
Yes. In my own life, yes. My wife diagnosed with cancer a year ago or so. We've spent the last year with chemotherapy and radiation. It's a very ugly business. And we've used humor to help us get through with that, to deal with that as effectively as possible. She came out of the surgery when they removed a big chunk of her colon. And as soon as she opened her eyes, she started naming off women in the ward I could marry. Says you can't marry Julie and you can't marry Sarah, and I don't want Martha touching any of my stuff. But yeah, I mean, you can use humor to do that. The greatest compliment I've ever gotten for my column was a woman who said my father was a stake president, had pancreatic cancer, excuse me, and in the last 2 months that he lived, the only time I ever saw him smile was when he read your column. And that's pretty amazing to me. Yes?
The question I wanted to ask was along those lines. I'm curious both how much positive feedback and how much negative feedback you get, and then how you would weigh the two, like the positive things like that must make up for it.
Yeah, 95% of the feedback I get is positive. I get anywhere from 50 to 150 letters and emails a week. The 5% that I get that's negative, the surprising thing is that the majority of it comes from non-Mormons. And in Utah, that's fairly easy to understand because you have this really angry minority living in the heavy shadow of a predominant faith. And the unfortunate part of being that minority is that they tend to believe that the responsibilities of behaving decently don't apply to them. And so I get a lot of angry feedback from Baptists, for example, who say, I don't know how you can be a Mormon. You seem to be an intelligent guy. Yes? Yeah, I'm going to shut it down right now. Okay, thanks.
So scoot to the next place you want to go. Thank you, Robert.